Welcome to Global Minnesota Podcasts, connecting, informing, and engaging Minnesotans with the world and exploring important international issues. For a complete list of programs and to join us, visit globalminnesota.org.
Thank you very much, Mark, for that overly generous introduction, and thank you all for coming out. I want to also extend my thanks in general to Global Minnesota and for its partners who Mark identified that make this sort of event possible. We are surrounded by some events that make the subject for this evening pretty timely. As you may know, there is an event going on as we speak in Warsaw, Poland, which was organized by our administration, focused on the Middle East, and I'll have some more things to say about that later. So we're nothing if not timely. The advertised subject is U.S. policy toward the Middle East, how it represents a reversal from some of what came before, what this means for the region, what the prospects are. And I will be talking about all that, but I want to begin with a kind of caveat. If we're discussing the current administration's policy toward the Middle East, there are some challenges in trying to identify just what the thrust of that policy is, because there are some reversals, not just with what came before, with Obama and others, but really reversals from what Mr. Trump has said himself. And I would pinpoint, for example, the issue of U.S. troops in Syria. The president made a statement or a tweet, however he came out with it, saying, we're getting out of Syria, and we're getting out soon. And then it wasn't long after that that his own national security advisor, Mr. Bolton, said, well, no, actually there's some conditions to this, which was really a walking back, although the White House would not call it a walking back. And now there's really some doubt as to exactly what the policy line on that is. There are reports that the Pentagon is preparing for getting all those 2,000 or so troops out by the end of April, but I think we have to say we'll just wait and see. And then there are other topics, such as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, in which early on in the 2016 presidential campaign, Mr. Trump talked about being even-handed. Since then, he really has changed his direction, and I think it's fair to say he's gone all in with the Netanyahu government in Israel, as exemplified by things like the move of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. And even more generally, during the campaign, there were a lot of people, including knowledgeable friends of mine whose perceptions on these things I respect, who saw Hillary Clinton as the more hawkish candidate and heard some of Mr. Trump's rhetoric as saying, we need to retrench and we've been involved in too many wars. He sounded like less of an interventionist than Mrs. Clinton. But since then, I mean, except for the initial announcement of Syrian troops and also a statement more recently about getting half of our troops out of Afghanistan, many of the other actions have been more interventionist, such as continuing to support the Saudi war in Yemen, and a lot of the aspects of policy toward Iran, which I'm going to get to in a moment. And underlying all this, I think we have to recognize this is an administration, as I suggested with the Syrian troop issue, that doesn't really speak with one voice and perhaps doesn't decide with one mind. Mr. Trump is one thing, Mr. Bolton is something very different. And Secretary of State Pompeo, in many respects, I would root more with John Bolton than with the president, even though he clearly has a far better relationship with the president than his predecessor, Rex Tillerson, did. Well, with all that as caveats, all right, my stab at trying to identify what the main themes and or drivers of the current administration's policy toward the Middle East would be as follows. It would be twofold. One is, do the opposite of what Obama did. And that's something I think we've seen in other aspects of this administration's policy, both foreign and domestic. Foreign, we've had things like the very early in the administration exit from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because that was seen as something that was an Obama project. And it's not just analysts who've said that. Really, the administration is saying it itself. And I would reference the speech that Secretary Pompeo gave last month in Cairo, which I'd say there were two takeaways from that speech. One, Iran is bad, and two, Obama was bad. And really, some experienced diplomats I've talked to who listened to that were frankly taken aback by how much a speech given in a foreign venue appeared to be devoted to what appears to be fighting domestic political battles back here in the United States. So that's kind of one theme. And then the other thing is something that really has a basis pre-Trump, and that is to look at the region in what I would describe as Manichaean terms. And by that I mean rigidly dividing things into good guys and bad guys, with Iran, of course, being the principal bad guy. And in which, for the bad guys, we don't have any dealings with them at all. It's all confrontation. And with the good guys, we cut them a lot of slack and don't bother making a case out of things that they do that might really be a cause for objecting. That's, as I say, it has roots pre-Trump. It's a way in which we Americans have tended to see much of the world more so than Europeans and others see the world. And there are reasons for this. I wrote much of a book about this topic. We can go into it later if you want. But that's not the only way in which one could look at the Middle East. One could look at it, say, the way Vladimir Putin does. And the issue of Russian influence in the Middle East has been a topic of a lot of discussion. Putin deals with everyone. I mean, he might describe some as more friends and some as more foes. I mean, certainly Syria, for example, he considers an ally, long been an ally of Russia and the Soviet Union. But he deals with Syria, with Israel, with Turkey, with Iran, with Saudi Arabia. It's a very flexible kind of diplomacy that, quite unlike our administration, doesn't divide the region rigidly into friends and foes and treat them vastly differently. Now, the emphasis, the very strong emphasis on confronting and stoking hostility to Iran clearly is the single substantive theme that rides through all of the administration's policy toward the Middle East. It is, I would say, one of the most consistent themes in this administration's policies worldwide, despite other things we can identify as inconsistencies. And that campaign of maximum pressure, as they call it, and ostracism and no engagement, fits each of these two overarching themes that I mentioned. If you ask what was the most significant foreign policy achievement of former President Obama, I think most people would say, and I would say, it was probably the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, otherwise known as the Iran nuclear deal. And so rejecting that, trying to destroy it, was one of the first goals of this administration, and I might add of most Republicans in Congress. Moreover, it fits in well with the preferences of some of the key good guys on the good side of that Manichaean divide in the region. I'm talking mainly about Saudi Arabia and Israel and the United Arab Emirates, which have their own reasons to want to continue to portray Iran as the source of everything foul and evil in the region. Now, this extreme high priority given to confronting and punishing Iran has gotten to the point where I would call it an obsession, and has become so all-consuming that various other objectives and interests of this administration and of the United States generally have taken a backseat to it. For example, it's a complication in trade issues because there's so much emphasis on enforcing the secondary sanctions as well as the primary sanctions as part of the maximum pressure on Iran. That has been a complication in the trade war, which is complicated enough as it is. Or related to that, you may recall the arrest of the Chinese Huawei executive, the woman who was arrested in Canada. There were a number of issues, of course, involved that get into trade problems with China. But you may remember the specific charge was, you know, Xi and Huawei were involved in violating the sanctions against Iran. So, you know, that was a driver of an issue that now has become a major complication in the relationship with China, not to mention complicating life for our Canadian friends. And most conspicuously, this whole issue has contributed, I would say, more than anything else to the marked downturn in relations between Washington and our most important European allies. There have been other issues, of course, as well, but I'd say this was the biggest one, in that the economic warfare that the administration is waging against Iran has, in effect, become also economic warfare against the Europeans because of the secondary sanctions. Now, the Europeans are fighting back, and they've had under development for some time something that went under the label of a special purpose vehicle, which would be something intended to get around some of the U.S. secondary sanctions. It was just within the last couple of weeks that the Europeans announced the standing up of this project. They gave it the name, a rather awkward acronym, of INSTEX, which stands for Instrument to Support Trade Exchange. I'll say a little bit more about that later as it specifically relates to Iran. But the main point I want to make right now is this is one more step that foreign governments, in this case the Europeans, have taken to try to get out of the reach of the United States and its exercise of financial and economic clout, exercise for political reasons. You know, we in the United States have had this this beneficial situation that flows from the dollar being the principal reserve currency and that flows from New York being the center of international finance. So our Treasury Department can do things like secondary sanctions that other countries can't so easily do. But the more we do that, the more we increase the incentive for the Europeans and the Chinese and others to try to find ways to work around that. And this particular device is one step toward that, which may cause us to regret later on other issues having nothing to do with Iran, our relative loss of economic and financial clout. Right now, it's the United States, not Iran, that is isolated on these various issues. I mentioned the conference in Warsaw, Poland. Clearly, the intention of the administration in getting the Poles to agree to host this was to try to reduce the apparent division between the United States and the Europeans on issues related to Iran, and to try to muster more enthusiastic support to confront Iran and wage this maximum pressure campaign. The Europeans, especially the West Europeans, were very cold on this, and their advice was, don't try it, it's only going to accentuate the divisions between us on this issue, and I'm afraid the Europeans were probably right about that. The speeches are continuing this week. I think what you're hearing for the most part from the U.S. representatives, including Vice President Pence, who is heading the U.S. delegation, and from Secretary Pompeo, is a very strong anti-Iran theme. And what you're hearing from some of the Europeans, at least the ones who decided to attend, is an effort to widen the scope so it's not just an Iran bashing party, but tries to have other things to say about security issues in the Middle East. That attendance, by the way, has been rather sparse. Ms. Mogherini, the European Union's foreign affairs chief, decided not to attend at all. The British foreign minister is leaving early. The Germans sent a rather junior minister for their foreign ministry. The French just sent a civil servant. So there clearly is not a lot of enthusiasm. But the United States and others who are its immediate allies, not too many of them, who are supporting this whole anti-Iran theme are doing their best to fire things up. Today in Warsaw, on the fringes of this meeting, Rudolph Giuliani was making a speech to a kind of side rally that was being organized by the MEK, which is this Iranian cult slash terrorist group which first showed his face when it was conducting terrorist operations against the Shah's regime, in which, among other things, it killed some American officials. It allied with the Khomeini revolutionists and later broke with the Khomeini people. When the Iran-Iraq war broke out, it threw in its lot, MEK did, with Saddam Hussein of Iraq and became essentially an auxiliary to the Iraqi security services. Not surprisingly, that was viewed by the overwhelming majority of Iranians as an inexcusable act of treason. And the group has now lost almost all of its support inside Iran. Nonetheless, it seems to have great funding from somewhere. And it gives people like Giuliani and before that John Bolton, when he was before he went back into government, five-figure fees to make speeches on their behalf. So that's something else that's been going on in Warsaw today. The roots of American attitudes toward Iran go back before Trump in a number of respects, in ways that unfortunately are not conducive to clear thinking. And this is true of both sides, actually. It's the Iranians' experiences with us, which have underlain a lot of the Iranian resentment of us, are based in events like the 1953 coup against Mossadegh, in which the US and Britain helped overthrow a popularly elected government and put back in power a Shah that then came to be seen as a harsh authoritarian ruler. It also includes the history of the Iran-Iraq War, in which we, the United States, sided with Iraq, except for during the Iran-Contra affair, which we consider a scandal. And in the closing months of which we had the shoot-down of an American Iranian airliner by an American warship, which many Iranians to this day still believe was intentional, even though it really was a case of tragic mistaken identity. And there are a whole host of other things that we can go on, right up to the hostility of the current administration. For us, I think the biggest event that stands out over anything else is the hostage crisis, 1979-1981, in which we had 50 of our diplomats taken prisoner, held hostage for over a year, a major act of international terrorism. It's understandable that we have never put that out of our minds. We can't forgive it, we can't forget it, we shouldn't. But that's about as awful a start as you could possibly have to a relationship with a new regime after somebody else's revolution. And that kind of primed us all to now see Iran as a bête noire that to which the same sort of general negative characterizations routinely roll off the lips of American politicians of both parties. Malign, nefarious, destabilizing behavior, number one supporter of terrorism, would-be regional hegemon, so on, so on, so on, so on. You've heard it all. And the problem with that is, one of the problems is, we almost never hear in the public discourse, and I'm not just picking on the administration, this really is the general public discourse, any more specifics beyond those general buzzwords of exactly what Iran is doing, of how what it does differs, if at all, from what other regional states do, of exactly how what it does affects or does not affect U.S. interests. And I might add, how what Iran does is so often a response to what somebody else does. And they've had a lot to respond to. Today, again, there was an attack in southeastern Iran, in which reportedly about 41 Revolutionary Guard were killed. Something else for Iran to respond to. They will try to respond to that. Just as they tried to respond to things like the terrorist attack in Ahvaz a few months ago, similar sort of thing, it was against the military parade, or the ISIS terrorist attack in Tehran about a year and a half ago, which was against the Iranian parliament building and the Khomeini Mausoleum. The equivalent for us would be if somebody attacked the U.S. Capitol and the Washington Monument in Washington, D.C. Or several years ago when it tried to, not very successfully I might add, attack some targets that has some kind of Israeli connection, with the timing and the method of the attacks, very clearly a retaliation or an attempt to retaliate for serial assassination of Iran's nuclear scientists that have been taking place over the several preceding months. As an indicator of how some of the thinking sometimes perhaps gets distorted, and let me just pick on, you know, that one thing we never hear about. How does what Iran does in the region stack up against what other states in the region are doing? And take one of Iran's principal regional rivals, Saudi Arabia. Now, President Trump tells us that one of the main reasons we have to be good friends with Saudi Arabia, and perhaps to, he doesn't put it in these terms, but look the other way when the Saudis do things that we might find objectionable, is that we need this united front in confronting Iran. Well, consider some of the things, the key things that Iran has done, that Saudi Arabia has done in the last year or so, especially since Mohammed bin Salman, the young crown prince, has taken power. Most conspicuously was the murder of Jamal Khashoggi in the consulate in Istanbul, which indicates that the Saudis are in the business of extraterritorial assassination of non-violent dissidents. Iran used to be in that business. In the first several years after the Iranian Revolution, they did a lot of that sort of thing in Europe, as well as Pakistan and some other places. They stopped doing that, assassination of non-violent dissidents, some time ago, but evidently the Saudis are still doing it. Fomenting instability in places like the Levant. Well, another thing that sticks out that happened just a few months ago was the Saudis took prisoner, basically, the Prime Minister of Lebanon, who was on a visit to Saudi Arabia, Saad Hariri, and they held him in a kind of house arrest until he made a statement announcing his resignation. And the apparent effort by the Saudis was to foment a governmental crisis back in Lebanon, and they evidently thought by doing this they would somehow, you know, weaken Lebanese Hezbollah and somehow strengthen Lebanese forces that were more friendly to Saudi Arabia. It didn't work. Hariri went off to France, he got the support of Macron, and then when he went back home to Lebanon, he rescinded his resignation, and he is the prime minister again today. But if you're asking, you know, who is destabilizing things in the region, I think it's kind of hard to ignore that. And then you've got something like the Yemeni war, which has become, by most measures, the worst man-made humanitarian catastrophe we have in the globe right now. And that is overwhelmingly due to the massive and indiscriminate air war that the Saudis have led along with their Emirati allies. So I think you have to ask, if we are doing things in the name of confronting somebody who is described as a destabilizing force in the region, and one of our means of doing that is to keep our relations smooth with someone else that has been at least as destabilizing as the target of our efforts, then I think it's appropriate to ask, are the means we're using really serving what supposedly are our ends? Well, whatever is the basis for the administration's policies on Iran, what are some of the prospects looking ahead? The central issue in all this Iran stuff over the last 2 or 3 years has been the nuclear agreement, formerly the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. And we should just review for a moment, you know, what that agreement did. Before it was negotiated, there was much concern, not just in the Obama administration, but among a lot of the people who talk a lot about Iran today, about the specter of a possible Iranian nuclear weapon. In response to what were then fairly comprehensive international sanctions, and with pressure being cranked up more and more, the Iranian response was to spin more and more enrichment centrifuges and enrich more and more uranium, and come closer and closer to having the fissile material to make a bomb should they choose to make one. The so-called breakout time that specialists talk about, the amount of time that a country would need to make a bomb if it decided to do so, was getting down to only like 2 or 3 months. Then, what was made possible, the negotiation of this agreement, were a couple of things. One was the replacement of Ahmadinejad, the former Iranian president, who was the Iranian leader everyone loved to hate for good reason, by Hassan Rouhani. But at least as important was the decision under the Obama administration to drop the demand for no enrichment, saying, again, have any nuclear program at all. That was simply a non-starter. Instead, the formula was place that nuclear program under severe restrictions and comprehensive international monitoring to make sure we close all paths to a possible Iranian nuclear weapon, and that's what the JCPOA did. And it not only froze the program, it pushed it back. It forced the Iranians to get rid of most of their enriched uranium, get rid of most of their centrifuges, fill up a reactor that could have produced plutonium with cement, and accept the most comprehensive monitoring by the International Atomic Energy Agency that any country that wasn't a loser in war has ever accepted. When you consider the alternative, and the alternative was the situation we had before, with more and more enrichment and getting down to 2 or 3 months of breakout time, the JCPOA was clearly superior. The opposition to it, therefore, has not really been based on mostly on issues of nuclear proliferation. It's been based on other motives for trying to keep Iran a pariah and isolated and not the subject of any agreements with anybody, especially with the United States. You can just look at how the emphasis has changed. Back before the JCPOA was negotiated, remember, for example, Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel, in one of his speeches to the UN General Assembly, had that cartoon bomb which he held up. And you know, that was a wonderful prop, because if you took out the same prop today and used it, you could trace how the JCPOA drained the bomb. You don't hear that from Mr. Netanyahu anymore, and you don't see his prop anymore, because he prefers now to talk about other things, all that other nefarious behavior and so on. The basis for the arguments to keep Iran as a pariah that we don't engage have changed. That was a measure of the success of the JCPOA. It did deal with the nuclear problem. Iran continues today to abide by its obligations under the JCPOA as repeatedly certified by the IAEA inspectors. Now, it's getting, by any account, a pretty lousy deal, because we pocketed all those restrictions and the inspections, but because the U.S. reneged on its obligations as of May of last year, the Iranians, because of that and all the secondary sanctions, are getting almost no economic benefit of the sort that they hoped for when they signed the agreement. Yet it continues, the regime continues to adhere so far. It clearly hopes for regime change in Washington in January 2021, hopes that there will be a new administration that will get back into the agreement and bring back where things were as of a couple of years ago. But with the U.S. reneging and ramping up the economic warfare, it is unclear, and I wouldn't be placing any bets of any large size one way or the other on this, whether the Iranians will be patient enough to wait out these next almost 2 years when they're basically not getting anything out of it economically. The hardliners in Tehran, ever since our administration reneged on the agreement, have been saying, "We told you so." These are among the elements that had argued against the agreement all along. They said, "Look, we said you should not negotiate with the perfidious Americans. Trump has done exactly what we warned you about." And so people like Rouhani, the president, and the foreign minister Zarif have very much been on the defensive, trying to say, "Let's stick with this agreement." Iran has been looking to the Europeans to try to take up some of the slack, from the U.S. reneging, and that's what where that Instex device that I mentioned before comes into play. It's basically a kind of clearinghouse for barter arrangements to bypass the international financial and banking system so it will stay out of the reach of the U.S. Treasury. So if, say, you had someone who wanted to sell airplane parts to Iran and you had someone else who wanted to buy pistachios from Iran, they would both have an account, if you will, with this Instex. And what would in effect wind up happening is that the pistachio buyer would pay the airplane parts seller, and it wouldn't go through any bank. I think this is going to have probably only a minor effect. And initially, this is supposed to just apply to humanitarian goods like food and medicine. It will help a little bit in circumventing some of the financial and banking problems, but it does not do away with what is the main cudgel that the U.S. Treasury still has, and that is the threat of being locked out of, effectively, of the U.S. market for companies that still want to do business in the U.S. market. And many larger firms that see the opportunities for business in the United States compare it to the much smaller opportunities in Iran, they know where their advantage would be, and they decide not to do business with Iran. So it is possible that sometime in the next couple of years, the hardliners will get their way, Rouhani and Zarif will be out, at least on this issue, and the Supreme Leader and whoever's calling the shots then in Iran will say, all right, that's enough. The U.S. reneged on this, and so the deal is off as far as we're concerned. And then we would be back to where we were before it was negotiated, with the centrifuges spinning up and more uranium being enriched, and we'd have a new nuclear crisis. And if that happens, then this would once again be an Iranian response to something somebody else did. In this case, what the U.S. administration did. Now, the Trump administration and other opponents of the nuclear accord have, of course, kept talking about getting a better deal. But it's now been, as I say, a good 9 months since the formal reneging last spring. And the maximum pressure campaign has been cranking away since then. And so far, there is no sign of the Iranian regime crawling back to the negotiating table to negotiate what we would consider a better deal. No sign at all. And that's not surprising. The JCPOA itself was laboriously negotiated. You know how athletes talk about leaving it all on the field? The negotiators left it all on the negotiating table. You had shouting matches between John Kerry and the Iranian foreign minister at the more difficult phase stages of the negotiation. We couldn't have gotten a better deal. And that was with broad international support for the sanctions then against Iran. Now, again, it's the United States that's isolated, except for Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. And we have, the Europeans, not to mention the Russians and Chinese, doing what they can to try to sustain commerce with Iran. For Iran, it has all the same considerations that we would have why we wouldn't want to crawl back to somebody else's negotiating table. Considerations of prestige and pride, these get invoked in debates inside Tehran. And meanwhile, U.S. credibility in Iranian eyes has gone down the drain. Any Iranian leader who says, well, I think we ought to negotiate with the Americans again, is immediately going to be met with the obvious rejoinder, look what happened when we negotiated an agreement just a couple of years ago. They reneged on it, we're getting nothing out of it. What a bad deal. And the Iranians haven't been given anything that they really can say yes to. Secretary Pompeo made a speech a while back in which he listed 12 demands, things that Iran had to do, not just in the nuclear area, but lots of other things, that Iran must meet before we do any business with them. And if you read the list, it's something that no Iranian leader could ever accept and politically live to tell the tale. When I saw the list, what it reminded me most of was the list of demands that Austria-Hungary made on Serbia in 1914, which were intended not to be accepted, but were intended to be rejected. So it would be a rationale for Austria-Hungary to launch its war against Serbia. Now, the administration also says that, well, even though they haven't crawled back to the negotiating table yet, the maximum pressure is having an effect in curtailing, because we're taking financial resources away from the Iranians, that nefarious behavior in the region. Now, the administration has had a hard time deciding exactly what line they want to take on this, and the president has successive tweets that are almost they are contradictory. On the one hand, saying, well, Iran is still doing all these bad things, and on the other hand, the president claims, since we started pressuring them, they're a different country. You know, they're behaving better now. Well, in fact, there hasn't really been any change one way or the other that can be traced either to the nuclear agreement or to the reneging on that agreement and the current maximum pressure campaign. There have been a couple of recent studies done on exactly this question, one by the Congressional Research Service and another by the International Crisis Group. They both looked at, you know, through the last several years, at the sanctions that have been and other forms of pressure placed on Iran, and what Iran has been doing in the region, how active it's been, how aggressive it could be described as, and asked, is there any correlation between the two? And the conclusion reached in each study was, no, there's no correlation. And that is also not a surprising result. Iran does what it does in the region, not because it has a few more rials in its bank account than it otherwise would have. It does the things it does because it sees security reasons for doing them. For example, it's devoted considerable effort over the last several years to assisting the Assad regime in Syria in its fight in the Syrian civil war. Why does it do that? Because Syria is the only long and strong alliance that Iran enjoys in the Arab world. So the relationship is extremely important to it. Thus, it's made this effort. That has nothing to do with the nuclear agreement, has nothing to do with maximum pressure. They're doing it for their own reasons that they consider important, having to do with regional politics and security. Unfortunately, the only prospect for change that I see in any of this over the next couple of years is the prospect for unfavorable change. And here what I'm talking about is the possibility of escalating to military conflict that would involve Iran and the United States and or Israel. There are some in the administration, and I would focus particularly on Mr. Bolton, who would welcome this. Before he went back in government, he was writing, such as in the op-ed page of the New York Times, we should bomb Iran. He's somebody, by the way, who still says the Iraq war was a good idea. Bolton made a request of the Pentagon, reportedly a little while back, for military options for attacking Iran. And the circumstances of when he did this point to how, even if neither Iran or the United States has really decided to go to war, we could have some incident spin out of control. The circumstances were, he made this request after there was some fighting in southeastern Iraq around Basra that kind of got out of control, and the Shia militia fired some rounds that came close to our U.S. consulate there. It didn't actually hit it, but it came close. And that was enough, evidently, in Mr. Bolton's mind to start talking about, you know, military strikes. We could also have the possibility of some naval encounter in the Persian Gulf. It's happened before. Remember back, this was still during the Obama administration, when a couple of our U.S. Navy small craft inadvertently entered Iranian territorial waters. The Iranians seized the craft and the crew and held them for about 24 hours. There were these pictures of our crewmen, you know, on their knees, and it was a nasty moment. Fortunately, as a result or a byproduct of the negotiations on the nuclear agreement, we had a working communication channel at the foreign minister level. And John Kerry picked up the phone and called Javad Zarif, and they resolved this thing in a matter of hours, and we got our boats and our crew safely back without further incident. We don't have that kind of channel of communications now, and I worry about what would happen if we had a similar incident occurring today. Now that's our part of it. Then I would also talk about the Netanyahu government in Israel. Mr. Netanyahu faces an election this spring, and he's also facing some corruption indictments. Although he's been, of course, extremely successful and has become one of the longest serving prime ministers in Israel's history, he's facing a lot of challenges. And he has always used his image as Mr. Security, the tough guy who is going to stand up for Israel's physical security, as his political trump card. And I think he's shown indications more recently of playing that card more aggressively. One indication is, it was just within the past couple of weeks, that his government started talking publicly about the repeated airstrikes he's been making against Syria, against supposedly Iranian-related targets. The Israelis have made somewhere between 100, maybe close to 200 strikes over the last couple of years. Most of them they don't say anything about, but just recently they made a public statement about it. Obviously an attempt to show this Mr. Security posture more. And then today, back at Warsaw, you know, Mr. Netanyahu was there for the conference, and he had an interview next to a skating rink of all places, according to the video, in Hebrew, so it was for a domestic audience, in which, according to the initial translation provided by the Prime Minister's office that gave the subtitles in English for the video, and they tweeted about it, he talked about how Israel and Arab states, and this came after he had a meeting with the Omani foreign minister, how Israel and Arab states are working toward our common interest in war with Iran. Now there's an issue whether that word was translated properly, and the Prime Minister's office later deleted the subtitles and the tweet, and according to native level Hebrew speakers who looked at it, the particular word he used could mean war in the physical sense, or it could mean kind of combating or fighting in a more metaphorical sense. Either way, he is clearly upping the rhetoric, and does it on the very day that Iran just, you know, had 41 deaths inside Iran from a terrorist attack. Okay, let's look at some of the other rest of the region, see if I can be more optimistic. Unfortunately, I can't. Syria, we've got, you know, this uncertainty about the U.S. troops, and we've got a lot of debate in this country about ISIS, which unfortunately, and we can talk about this more if you want, overlooks the differences between to what extent ISIS is still a threat, and the issue of whether a physical haven somewhere in Syria, how that does or does not relate to threats we face here in the West, and the further question of how a couple of thousand U.S. troops relate to either the physical haven or the terrorist threat that we face in the West. All of this takes place in the confusing context of the Syrian civil war, which at this point, the Assad regime, thanks in large part to help from its Russian and Iranian friends, but especially the Russians that were able to apply air power, have mostly won the war. I mean, not completely, but they basically won. And so if we really were serious about making sure ISIS doesn't raise its ugly head as far as it did when it had this whole mini-state across much of Syria and Iraq, probably the best way to do it is to condone the Assad regime reaffirming authority over all of Syrian territory. Of course, we don't like that because we don't like that regime. But if ISIS is our worry, that's the best way to handle it. And as unsavory as that regime is, we also ought to remind ourselves that it has been in power, it meaning either father Hafez Assad or son Bashar Assad, the current president, for almost half a century. It was 1970 when Hafez Assad took power in a coup. And somehow we've managed to live with them. And our Israeli friends have also managed to live with them, as the devil they know better than some of the devils they don't know so well. Yemen, the war trundles on, even though we've had some semi-promising diplomacy taking place with a ceasefire around the port of Hodeidah, but the war is a long ways from being solved. one possible glimmer of hope with regard to the U.S. attitudes toward this is a silver lining that comes out of the tragic Khashoggi affair. And that is, it caused a lot of people in this country to take a second look at exactly what kind of ruler Mohammed bin Salman really is. You know, he was getting lots of good press over here as the young reformer. Tom Friedman was singing his praises. And I think the Khashoggi affair got a lot of people to take a second look and see exactly what kind of ruler he is, a much darker one. It actually got the U.S. Congress to take one action to show its independence from the administration with regard to the Yemeni war. Now, some people complain there ought not to be a connection between the Yemeni war and Khashoggi. You know, as a formal matter, there shouldn't be. But there was a political effect here that I think, as I say, was the silver lining in what was otherwise a tragic event. But I'm still not optimistic about the current administration revising its Saudi policy enough to really have a difference in Yemen. Now, the one other place in the region where there might be at least some apparent movement in the weeks and months ahead has to do with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And there we've had the long-awaited Jared Kushner peace plan. Well, you know, don't laugh. Everything else about the administration's policies on this issue should lead us to expect that whatever Mr. Kushner comes up with will be a non-starter from the Palestinian point of view. I'm pretty confident it will be. But along with that, we've had in Israel the hardening and strengthening of the Israeli right wing, with elements inside Netanyahu's own government that are opposed to anything that even smells like a two-state solution. So I think there's going to be objections heard from Israel as well as from the Palestinians to whatever may turn out to be the Kushner plan. As far as the timing of it is concerned, I think the U.S. administration will probably release it at the time that Netanyahu wants it to be released. And for him, the most advantageous time would be right after his election, which is supposed to be in April, but before he forms a new coalition. So in other words, it won't be a drag on him vis-a-vis his right-wing opponents as far as the election is concerned, but then he can use it as a kind of leverage in trying to form a new coalition. We'll see. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has been hoping all along that Arab states, and particularly Saudi Arabia under the Crown Prince, will lean on the Palestinians, twist their arms, to get them to accept what would otherwise be unacceptable to them. This has been known as the outside-in strategy. And the strategy has some basis in that if you look at somebody like Mohammed bin Salman, I don't think he, the welfare of Palestinians is very high on his list of priorities. Nonetheless, the Palestinian cause still has an awful lot of resonance in the Arab world, on the street as well as in capitals. And it is particularly worth noting that King Salman, MBS's father, despite his declining faculties and his relinquishing most of his powers to his son, this is the one issue where he has weighed in and, in effect, preempted Mohammed bin Salman by reiterating that the Saudi position is firmly in favor of the Arab League peace plan, which calls for looking at the 1967 borders as the basis for any territorial settlement in return for complete recognition of Israel by all Arab countries and a closing of the file on this issue. Just this week, over the last couple of days, Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority president, was in Riyadh. He met with the king. A statement was issued in which the king reaffirmed that position as I just described it, reaffirmed Saudi commitment to support the Palestinians for a state with East Jerusalem as its capital. And then there was a story I read in Times of Israel, but I think it was based, this was just this today I was reading it, it was based on a Palestinian news report that Abbas had also met with the Crown Prince. And a similar statement came out of that, or a similar report, that the Crown Prince obviously is falling behind his father, in line behind his father on this issue, and talked about, yeah, we're committed to a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital. That is not what we are likely to see in the Kushner plan. And I might add, of course, anything that is foisted on one of the parties in a dispute like this really isn't a peace plan. You can't take away nationalist aspirations of Palestinians any more than you can with anyone else. Well, let me just finish with a couple of general observations about this region. You know, today, it's not like the Cold War, where we looked at the Middle East as a chessboard in which we were playing a game with the Soviets. And you're counting, you know, which regime was in their camp and which regime was in ours. But the Manichaean approach, as I described with the current administration, rigidly dividing the region into good guys and bad, does make it almost seem that way. And Secretary Pompeo has been talking about trying to put together a Middle East security alliance, which would be like a NATO for the Middle East. Now, some of the questions that outside analysts have raised about this has to do with things like the Saudis' quarrel with the Qataris, where even the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council states, the Gulf Arabs, are divided among themselves. Well, that's one set of problems. I think the more fundamental issue is, if you're talking about a NATO for the Middle East, what are you protecting against, and in favor of whom are you protecting them? You know, what really are the interests at stake here? NATO was initially formed to keep the Red Army from overrunning Western Europe. And then after the end of the Cold War, if NATO still has a mission today, it presumably has something to do with protecting Western-style liberal democracy from more authoritarian forms of political rule. But here in the Middle East, whom are we aligned with? Highly authoritarian regimes. Freedom House, the watchdog group that looks at civil liberties and political rights worldwide, just put out its latest annual report a couple of weeks ago. They have this score system where you can go from 0 to 100 according to where you are on civil liberties and political rights. The top scorers are Nordic countries like Sweden and Finland and Norway that score 100. The bottom score this time was Syria, with I think about 5. And you know, Iran is fairly low, but Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, they're all even lower than Iran. And General al-Sisi's Egypt, which has become a very authoritarian and harshly ruled state, also scores very, very low, but that would be part of this Middle East security alliance. Much is going to come down to our own domestic politics. You know, I mentioned the possibility of Mr. Netanyahu being tempted, perhaps, of using the instigation of warfare as leaders through the centuries have used it, as the ultimate rally around the flag device that would boost his political support. Here in this country, I don't think Donald Trump wants a war with Iran. I think what he would most want is, he hopes still that the Iranians will crawl back to the negotiating table and he can get something that he can describe as a better deal. But he faces, of course, well-known domestic problems as well, the Mueller report, everything else. And he also has John Bolton, who, quite frankly, could outsmart him on some of these things. But as for, you know, going to the great distraction of a war, I might also note that private citizen Donald Trump, back around the time of the 2012 election, put out a series of tweets suggesting that Barack Obama would start a war with Iran for that reason, to distract attention from his political problems and rally around the flag. So clearly Trump has thought about this and sees it as a device. Well, if I can end on at least a halfway optimistic note. If the Iranians could somehow overcome their internal political impediments to going back to the negotiating table, and I'm not predicting that they will. As I said before, any Iranian leader that raised his hand and said, let's go back and negotiate with the Americans, is probably going to be shouted down in the councils inside Tehran. But if they could somehow overcome that, and this would be my advice to the Iranian leaders if I could give it right now, I would say, look at how Donald Trump operates. He's clearly more interested in the appearance of progress than the reality. I mean,
like the North Korea thing, you know, where he describes it as a horrible situation, and then he holds one meeting with Kim Jong-un, and he says, the nuclear problem of North Korea has been resolved. If the Iranians went back and said, they said, okay, we'll negotiate with you, Trump, and then make it like NAFTA, where, what did Trump do with that? It was renamed, there were some relatively minor changes, and then he was able to say, I've replaced that horrible deal with a much better deal. Mr. Supreme Leader in Iran, let Trump do that, and then just sit back and hold your fire while he claims victory and talks about what a tremendously better deal he got, even though you just made a few concessions. You know, maybe tweak the sunset clauses a little bit, and you get out from under the U.S. sanctions, and then we get back to business. Well, again, I don't predict that the Iranians politically would have the flexibility to do that, but that's my one optimistic wish. I'm going to stop there, and Mary Curtin's going to come up to the stage to moderate Q&A and discussion, so we'll have a hiatus of just half a minute, and then we'll get out the microphones.
Thank you for that really in-depth discussion of so many different issues in the Middle East and U.S. policy toward the Middle East. I think that the folks from Global Minnesota are passing around cards on which you can write questions, and obviously the bigger that you can write, the better for me if I'm going to be reading them. And try to make a clear short question so that we can get through several things. So I'm really happy to be here. We had a chance also to have Dr. Pillar over at the Humphrey School this afternoon. And the question that I was left with there, and that I was thinking about again tonight, and then someone asked a question sort of like this. There are a couple of interesting issues about Saudi Arabia. You talked about current administration's policies and that sort of dividing of the good guys and bad guys, despite some of the things that we see Saudi Arabia doing. But that close relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia isn't new. I mean, as you and I, and I think everyone here knows. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit more, not so much about just this administration, but why the United States has often or always been hesitant to say, come down hard on Saudi Arabia, and has that sort of reflexive view of Saudi Arabia as sort of essential to our security.
Yeah, it certainly has had a long history, which in effect started during World War II when Franklin Roosevelt met with Ibn Saud, the founder of the modern Saudi kingdom, during on a warship in the Suez Canal. And all along, you know, the big background motivation is spelled OIL, it's oil. That was our main concern back then, and it has always been the subtext of just about everything that comes up with Saudi Arabia. Now, there have been changes. I think that motivation ought to be looked at somewhat differently. Changes in the oil market, the fracking revolution here in this country, recent years has made a big difference in terms of how U.S. interests fit into the oil trade. But I think the main sort of political and psychological consequence for us Americans today is we've been so long in the habit of looking at the Saudis as an ally and friend, going back to World War II and that meeting in the Suez Canal. It's become as much of a habit as we look at Iran as an intractable foe. And that kind of background, shall we say, historical mood music, if I can put it that way, is a major factor in shaping this. So you're quite right to bring this out. We're not talking just about the Trump administration. I think the specific issues have been more acute when something like the Khashoggi murder occurs. And I think it's fair to say that there was less of a response by the current administration than there would have been if a different set of grand strategy policies in the Middle East under a different president were in effect. But the history is very important.
Thanks. You ended up talking about your fear, I guess, that there are people in the administration who think that war with Iran would be a good idea. But a couple of questions. How would the Russians respond to, you know, any move by the United States or United States and Israel and Saudi Arabia to any attack on Iran? And how do those people like Bolton, who are advocates for that, see managing the fallout from that war? That we see the fallout now from the war in Iraq. Do you see any discussion of that among people? So how might the Russians respond, and how would proponents of military action respond?
I think the Russians would let us stew in our own juice. And it would not be something like World War II, when you had a double intervention. The British invaded Iran from the south, and the Soviets invaded from the north. No, it's nothing like that. I think they would. Vladimir Putin would probably shake his head and say, "Well, I wonder if the United States are getting to yet another Vietnam." Well, I don't think it would be anything like that, and I don't think Putin realizes, as a matter of scale or length, it would be. But the Russian response, I don't think, would be a major factor one way or the other. As to the second part of your question, I certainly wouldn't pretend to read the mind of John Bolton or someone else, and I can't fairly replicate whatever the thinking is. And I suppose the fair thing would be to have one of those people on this stage and they could explain it themselves. But my best guess is it's sort of like Jerry Rubin saying we're going to groove on the rubble. And the idea of, say, a military strike, and it would be seen as just a bunch of airstrikes, not anything like a prolonged ground war, would be a catalyst, along with the economic pressure, for this regime collapsing. And then the further assumption, of course, is that whatever emerged out of the rubble would be more to our liking than the current regime. I think both of those assumptions are in error. On the second one, whether it was a result of a catalyzing military strike or any other reason, if we are going to see regime change in Iran in the near future, I think it's more likely for the worse from our point of view rather than for the better. The most likely change would be in the direction of something that would be akin to a military dictatorship by the Revolutionary Guard Corps. As I told you, the hardliners have the upper hand right now politically, and there simply is not the kind of there isn't a liberal democratic opposition that is going to pick up the reins of power. The fact that we have this dalliance by the likes of Mr. Bolton and Mr. Giuliani with the MEK of all people underscores the absence of an alternative that we can see as a new regime that really would be more to our liking.
So a couple of people actually asked if you could speak a little bit about Turkey's role in all of this. They are themselves at times allied with different countries within the region. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think the main observation I'd make about Turkey, and a whole bunch of complexities we could take a lot of time going into, but relevant to my earlier comments, it's one of the ways in which this good guy versus bad guy division just breaks down totally. I mean, Turkey is a NATO ally of ours. They ought to be seen as a good guy in many respects. But here we are in northern Syria on opposite ends of a local struggle where we are seeing as friends, and there's a lot of talk among those who argue against the withdrawal of those 2,000 U.S. troops, a lot of arguing about not abandoning our Kurdish allies who have fought against ISIS, whereas those same Kurdish allies are regarded by the Turkish government as basically an extension of the PKK, the Turkish terrorist group, which has killed many, many Turks in an insurgency and terrorist campaign that's lasted decades. So, life is complicated in that part of the world, and the issues that involve Turkey are one of the additional sets of complications.
And you know, that's also an area that has changed so much, because before the conflict broke out in Syria, of course, Turkey and Syria were trying to play a role also in negotiations. So there's a lot of change there. Several people asked if you would talk a little bit about the evolution of sectarianism in the region and how much the tensions between Sunni and Shia sects of Islam drive the conflicts and the shifting alliances.
Well, it's a big part. It's not, you know, the sole explanatory factor. It's actually one of the additional questions I would raise when talking about something like this Middle East Security Alliance that Pompeo is discussing. Does that mean there's some reason we should side with Sunnis against Shia? What, you know, establishing religion against, contrary to our First Amendment? You know, I don't see that as in the U.S. advantage at all. But yet, we've had an upsurge, I think, in the region in sectarian consciousness and sentiment since our invasion of Iraq in 2003, because that, you know, touched off a war inside Iraq, which had a strong sectarian dimension, as well as an ethnic dimension, insofar as the Kurds are involved. And that, I think, has had some spillover effect in the way sectarian majorities and minorities elsewhere in the region see themselves and identify themselves. It's been a contributory factor in a number of these problem areas, but not the sole one. For example, the Iranian alliance with Syria. That was really born in a common opposition to Saddam Hussein's Iraq. It had that political basis, it now has an economic basis. It does have somewhat of an additional sectarian basis in that the Alawites, who dominate the ruling clique in Syria, are, you know, more or less Shia, more Shia than Sunni, and therefore there's this identity with the Shia of Iran. Similarly, the Houthis in Yemen, whom the Iranians have been supporting, they are another variety of Shia fighting against predominantly Sunnis. But that, I would say, you know, as well as in Syria, is not the main factor that motivates what the Iranians are doing.
Thanks. There have been also a couple questions about the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And you mentioned that recently King Salman reiterated his support for the traditional tenets of solution. But you know, a couple questions: is there not more that the key players, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and others, could do to support the Palestinians? Whether that would be more muscle in the negotiation or more financial support? And if not, why are they not doing that?
Well, there's been a lot of financial support through the years, and now this is a bit more of an issue in that the United States administration has cut off everything in the way of USAID and taken away its contributions to UNRWA, the UN relief agency that serves Palestinians. But I think we do have to recognize, and this is the sort of valid basis behind the current administration's outside-in strategy, that this is not one of the higher priorities for the likes of the Saudi regime. I mean, they've got bigger worries than that. And the Yemeni war is one of them. So I don't see either that regime or the Emiratis devoting a whole lot more resources, either political resources or time or economic resources, to this problem, especially when they don't see a U.S. administration that really is on a course that they would go along with in terms of a final settlement.
Thank you. And just to go a little further afield, would you be able to talk just a little bit about the plans for the United States to pull out of Afghanistan, or the recent developments and negotiations between the United States and the Taliban? and how that might impact U.S. relations with Pakistan.
Okay, I've written about this, and I'm on record as applauding the diplomatic efforts of Zalmay Khalilzad, whom I know, in at least getting to where he is so far with a partial agreement with the Taliban, which involves certain pledges by the Taliban in return for evacuation of U.S. forces. This war has, for the United States, gone on, as you know, more than 17 years. There is not an upward trend here. It is very hard for anyone to argue with a straight face that either we're winning, or to argue for the umpteenth time that victory is around the corner, or we're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, or what have you. I think we missed the main off-ramp after the initial couple of months of the intervention, when we ousted the Taliban from its position of power in Kabul and rousted al-Qaeda from what was then its home in Taliban-ruled Afghanistan. I think there's been too much cynicism expressed about the Taliban pledge that is part of this partial understanding that Khalilzad has obtained, a pledge not to have anything like its hosting of al-Qaeda ever occur in the future. There is good reason to believe that that is very much in line with the Taliban's own incentives. The Taliban are not an international terrorist group. They are a very insular group that is concerned about the social and political order inside Afghanistan, and basically about not anything else outside Afghanistan except when it interferes with their plans inside Afghanistan. The worst thing that ever happened to them was our response to the al-Qaeda attacks in 2001. They don't want anything like that to occur again. So to finally get at least one hand on a new exit ramp, I think, is an encouraging development. And this war that has gone on longer than our involvement in World War I, World War II, and Korea, and a bunch of others all put together, has gone on too long already. And I wish the rest of the diplomacy well.
Back to the Gulf region, why has the United States not done more to try to resolve the tension between Qatar and the Saudis, especially since we have bases in Qatar, and it would seem to be to the U.S. advantage to try to help resolve that issue?
Well, it certainly would be to our advantage. Now, we had, as you may recall, when Rex Tillerson was still Secretary of State, some kind of mixed signals from the Secretary of State in the White House. That's one problem that sort of slowed the process all down. But I think the basic difficulty is we want to be friends with both sides of that. And we see ourselves as having security and military equities on both sides of that. And anything you do that would accommodate the, or be seen to accommodate the interests and objectives of one side would be taken as a negative by the other side. It's the same kind of tendency towards zero summing that makes it difficult to address other problems like the India-Pakistan conflict in South Asia, where the intense zero summing by both of those sides means you can't do anything with regard to one of those two parties that if regards as favorable without being seen as a negative step by the other one. So, sure, we have a strong interest in it, but it's a tough diplomatic nut to crack, and I don't fault either Tillerson or Pompeo or the current administration for not being able to crack it.
Thank you. This is going to be our last question. There's a lot of questions that we didn't get to, but there was one question about your thoughts about the long-term impact on the intelligence community of some of the attacks on the community and the public debates, given your long career. I'd like to say a few words about that.
Well, it's part of the territory. Intelligence officers and agencies have had to deal with this sort of thing with previous administrations. I mean, every situation is a little bit different, but during the last few years of my career, I was basically the senior intelligence community guy for political and economic analysis on the Near East and South Asia. And this was during the time that the Iraq War was sold and launched. those were rough times. I was happy when my retirement day came. And, you know, intelligence officers don't have a right to be heated. Policymakers have to have the right and the responsibility to exercise their own judgment, including on matters that are appropriate fodder for the intelligence agencies to weigh in on. When we had this most recent episode with the presentation of the annual worldwide threat testimony, in which the intelligence chiefs before Congress were basically doing their job, calling the shots as they see them. They weren't going out of their way to poke a stick in the policymaker's eye. This is an annual exercise that's done every year with an unclassified as well as a classified version. And I think after there were the presidential tweets about they're naive and they got to go back to school and all that sort of stuff, there would be, you know, a little bit of head shaking, but people would go back to their desks and their cubicles and they would stay in their lane and they would do their jobs. And I don't think there's going to be long-term damage from that. It comes with the territory, and if you can't take that sort of thing, you ought to get into a different line of business.
Well, thank you all, and thank you.